You take great care of your body, so why not do the same for your mouth? Zendium toothpaste is inspired by the power of the mouth to naturally protect itself. With a prebiotic benefit, it's clinically proven to boost the good bacteria in the mouth's microbiome and gives you strong teeth and healthy gums naturally, and is also four times gentler. Zendium, natural protection, clinically proven. Buy now at zendium.co.uk. Use code HEALTHYMOUTH for free shipping.
Adoration doesn't come along easily. No one knows that better than Raheem Sterling. Vilified and criticised, there was a time when, despite being the most exciting young English talent in a generation, he was also one of the most unpopular footballers in the country. Those days are behind him now. Not only has he progressed on the pitch to become one of the best players in the world, he's spoken out on social issues, including press ethics and racism, to become one of the game's most widely respected figures. Adored, you bet. So what's the story here? How did he change? Or did he change us? The man himself reveals all in the forthcoming issue of 442. I'm Connor Pope, and for today's episode, I speak to my colleagues Chris Flanagan and Hunter Godson about going to meet Sterling, and to Stephen McInerney, the man behind the Man City YouTube channel Esteemed Company, about one of the greatest club sides this country has ever seen, and the role Raheem Sterling has had in shaping that. Chris, Hunter, you are the two that went to interview Raheem for the new magazine. What kind of person is he like? Chris, let's start with you. I know you've interviewed him before, so you've met him on a couple of occasions. Do you think he's changed over time?
Yes and no. When I spoke to him first, I think it was about 3 years ago. I think it was just after the Euros. And he's definitely, he's more open now, and obviously he's more opinionated. I think he's got that confidence to be a bit more opinionated. But there's still certain things. It was interesting, it kind of went in a similar way both times, in that we quite often we'll do the photos first when we meet a player. And he came in on both times, the last 3 years ago and this time. Mm. And he was, you know, he's very friendly, shook hands, and, you know, was absolutely, you know, was lovely in terms of how he greeted us. But then he's very, noticeably very quiet. For 5 or 10 minutes, just kind of while we're doing the photos. Mm. You know, it was difficult to get a bit of small talk and banter out of him, which is fair enough. I think, and what actually came up in the interview afterwards, he was saying that he's always been like this, in that when he meets new people, or, you know, people he doesn't know so very well, he'll just spend a few minutes just sussing them out.
Right, okay.
Naturally, you know, if you're a superstar that everyone wants a piece of these days, you've got to be careful who you trust.
Yeah,
you meet a lot of people. So, you know, obviously his relationship with the media hasn't always been easy. So in the media, he probably needs to figure out which people he's willing to trust as well. So,
Hunter, this was the first time you'd met him. Did he suss you out?
I agree with what Chris said. Basically, as he walked over, he sort of looked at us, and I don't know what he was expecting. I don't know whether they'd sort of briefed him on what our setup was, but as he came over, quite meek. And then we asked him to take his shirt off, not just because we wanted to see what was underneath, but because we had a shirt for him to put on. I don't know, it's kind of awkward. A guy you've never met walks over, and 2 minutes after that, you're going, "Oh yeah, could you put this on, please, mate?" And he's putting that on. By the time he'd done the interview and everything, he was chatting. He was asking how we were getting home. You know, he was asking if I was going with Chris, and I was like, "No, I'm getting the train." He's like, "Why are you getting the car with him? Go on!" He just sort of came to life. But you know, you can understand why maybe it takes him a while.
I think it's interesting, Chris, what you say about he's become more opinionated over the years. In fact, he does say in the interview, you know, when you're young, you don't want to upset anyone. Yeah. You don't want any more noise than you're already getting. Obviously, he was, you know, such an expensive player, already a superstar as a teenager. He says, so you bite your tongue and leave it. But if you feel strongly about something, then you have to have that.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect that when he did speak out last year, he spent years not really, well, as you say from that, not really wanting to do it. And it was only because he was pushed into this stupid situation where he was getting this criticism, and then what happened at Chelsea, that it got to a point where he had to say something. And that I suspect, had his career not gone how it's gone in the last, had it been a smooth progression, he may not have reached this point where he has to speak out. And actually, it's been a very good thing both for him and for what he stands for. But I think although he was quiet when he came in for the photos, but you know, like Hunter was saying, during the interviews, he was really engaging, and he got very talkative and very friendly. And it was a pleasure to speak to him. I only had a shorter chat with him 3 years ago. It was maybe 10, 15 minutes. But even in that time, it was noticeable how much he opened up. And this time, you know, we had best part of 45 minutes. And it was a really nice chat. He was really good. And like Hunter says, by the end, he was laughing and joking and a real good rapport.
Mm. What I found really interesting was that for someone who has a reputation of being quite outspoken now, we wanted to use some of the audio in this podcast, but actually listening back to it, he's so softly spoken that the quality kind of wasn't quite good enough. I think listeners would have had to be straining just to hear the words. Yeah. I think that's a kind of a weird thing. But obviously it was also in the training complex with some 8-year-olds playing next
year,
wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. I mean, basically it was a massive indoor hall at Man City's. I mean, Man City's a training ground is amazing, by the way. And like there's a dividing curtain between the kids' 8-year-old training session and then us and a few other media. They're doing their things, and we had Raheem Sterling there. And it was funny how this kid's game was going on, and a few minutes in, this ball just came around the dividing curtain, and they obviously had absolutely no clue that Raheem Sterling was on the other side of this curtain. So one of the kids came through, and suddenly he's face to face with Raheem Sterling. He's like he's stunned, doesn't he?
Yeah,
he was. And then, interestingly, for the next 5 or 10 minutes, a lot of football seemed to start arriving, and we thought, yeah, that's probably they knew why they were kicking it.
These are 8-year-olds who are quite good at football. Yeah. So if they want to stick it over the other side of a curtain,
all wanted to see Raheem Sterling by that point. Yeah,
they also one of them had clocked that Kevin De Bruyne was sort of mulling around the other end of the pitch. So then slowly they were all going that way as well, which was great.
Because also I find that the idea he does get this label of being outspoken is not quite right, because certainly it seems he's very specific about what he says.
Yeah.
Do you get that sense that he's careful about his words?
Well, like I say, I mean, I don't think he's outspoken for the sake of it. Like I say, it took years to get to this point, and that was because he was pushed in the direction where he had to say, well, enough's enough. So he's certainly not a natural person who would have taken this on.
Yeah.
And like you say, he is very softly spoken and was very careful to choose his words on certain subjects. Mm. But he's, you know, he started to speak out last year. It obviously was very well received, that people agreed with him and he was right to say what so I think that fear of, like you say, he had that fear 2 or 3 years back, that if I say something and people don't react in the right way, this will make things worse for me. Yeah. Now he has said something and people didn't react in the wrong way, they actually agreed with him. He thinks, well, okay, I can say something now and don't have to feel afraid about it. And I think that's great.
I think that's interesting what you say about this being not something that would be natural to him, and that's something he feels he has a responsibility to do, almost something that has happened to him.
Yeah.
There's a great quote where he says people now come up to him in the street and they thank him for standing up for himself, but also for standing up for
a
whole society, he says, which is a really interesting comment into the way that he thinks. And I mean, usually I try and keep this podcast on big topics and not be topical, because I think there are a lot of topical football podcasts out there.
Yeah.
But I think we do have to touch a little bit about what happened this week. Obviously, on Monday night, England played in Bulgaria and the team's black players were targeted with racist abuse. There were organised neo-Nazis in the crowd. Yeah. The Bulgarian manager played it down, the incident, and Bulgarian journalists heckled Gareth Southgate at the conference afterwards. Now, Raheem is obviously one of the most eloquent voices on racism in football, but he also scored 2 goals on Monday. We didn't really cover racism in this interview because he wanted to talk about the positive aspects of football and about his game. But
yeah, I think he was keen to talk about football in this one, yeah.
But what kind of other stuff did come up, do you think?
Well, I mean, what we did obviously talk about is the criticism he's received. Now, part of that is around what happened in terms of leaving Liverpool. Part of that is the press coverage he's had on a wider scale of the last, well, probably 5 years now.
Yeah.
And how he felt about that. That he felt that for a long time he felt there were people who just didn't want him in the England team, no matter how well he played, no matter how well he played for Man City. That he said in the interview that before I stepped onto that pitch for England, he felt people were ready to criticise him.
Yeah.
Mm. And it's obviously fantastic now that he, by his performances, has completely turned that around. And, you know, the whole country, you know, loves him now and has huge respect for what he's doing. And I think that when we talked about it in the interview, the key game for me was Spain in the Nations League, in that he'd gone 27 games without a goal for England. So even in the World Cup, where he played well, he was part of a team that got to the semi-finals, there were still some people moaning at him because he'd not scored.
Yeah.
The fact when he scored those two goals before half-time in Spain, and then has gone on to score very regularly ever since for England, there's absolutely nothing left you can criticise him for anymore. There shouldn't have been anything to criticise him for before that, really, but people were still doing it. Now, you can't criticise him. He's speaking out on topics that are right to speak about, but he's doing the business on the pitch. There's nothing to criticise him for anymore.
He's afforded himself the platform, though, because where social media is the most damaging thing for a player's brand, it can also help them. And before, when he was getting criticism from these, the certain areas of the press, he still felt that people were saying, well, that's a completely unfair criticism. We shouldn't be allowing them to say this. But the player himself wasn't speaking out. And after he's come out, you know, he's built this platform now where no one would dare touch him because of the backlash that they'd get. And, you know, that's where he deserves great credit, because he's completely come out and changed his perception. And he's created it himself. He's created an atmosphere that other players feel like they can do it as well now.
Can I ask you quickly about the cover? Frankly, I think it's one of my favourite 442 covers probably ever.
Yeah.
It's Raheem Sterling wearing the Manchester City away shirt from 1999 when they won the playoff final to get out of what was then Division 2, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah,
Division 2. Yeah, Division 2, yeah.
But I think it also works because Raheem Sterling himself is something of a kind of style icon. He's very cool. Do you think that's an element of his?
I think if you look at this cover, it oozes confidence. It oozes cool. There's no question that the guy knows what he likes. I mean, even when we asked him to take that shirt off, as I sort of took it off him, he gave me his rings as well. And I was like, my goodness. I think I made a comment, actually. He gave me his watch. I was like, right, I'm off. That's me for life. It's just incredible. The guy like you said, he has become a style icon. Not just because, and I've said this before, but style icons these days, they don't just dress well. But, you know, they believe in not necessarily a political stance, but they have
attitude, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And they believe in something. And, you know, younger people now, they are more driven towards people who stand for a certain, a certain political stance, a certain social stance. And Raheem is one of those guys.
That's interesting. Now, you also asked him about Messi and Ronaldo.
Yes.
Can we compare? He's one of the best in the world now. We know that. That's not really up for debate. How close is he to touching those two, do you think? And how did he respond to that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the comparisons are definitely happening now. There's been plenty of people in, you know, pundits and stuff who have started to at least talk in those terms, even if not saying, you know, quite on that level. As he said himself, he's not there yet. And he doesn't claim to be, and in fact doesn't really want to be seen as being, you know, he's got massive respect for two absolute legends of the game. The interesting thing for me, and I think Jamie Carragher talked about this as well, is that his progression reminds me of Ronaldo a little bit, in that for a long time as a teenager, even early 20s, everyone knew how good he was, had all the skills, knew he was capable of kicking on, but just couldn't score regularly for some reason. And then Ronaldo did it at 21, 22, never stopped since. Yep. Sterling has now, in the last couple of years, started doing it and has showing absolutely no signs of stopping. And it was interesting what he talked about in the interview, in that he's saying, well, yeah, there is a similarity. He's not saying that he's on Ronaldo's level, but it was an interesting similarity in that he felt that watching Ronaldo and himself, that when you break into a team at 18 or however old, and you're seen as this big new up-and-coming star, you want to do all your skills and show, yeah, I am this great new talent. Yeah. And in fact, we talked about his debut for Liverpool, where he said his thought in his mind when he came on was, how many stepovers I can do in this game? And he said he got three or four in. And for, Ronaldo, you remember all the stepovers he used to do when he was 18, 19?
Yeah.
And it was almost probably too much, really. And maybe it was Sterling also was focused on wanting to show his ability and his skills. And it got to a point for Ronaldo and for him as well, where people said, well, that's great, but you should score some more goals. And he said the penny eventually dropped for him that, actually, yeah, maybe they're right. And then started to focus on how can I score more goals.
Mm. Wasn't it his mum who was berating him for not getting in the box enough?
That's right, yeah, that's part of it, yeah. Yeah, I think when I spoke to him last time 3 years ago, that was certainly a thing that was being said at the time. Like, his mum was telling him, get in the box, that's why you're not scoring more. And the amount of goals he scores now through arriving at the back post for a tap-in.
Yeah.
And, you know, by no means the only goals he scores, but that must add at least 10 to his tally each season. It reminds me of Robert Pires in the Invincibles team for Arsenal, and that they'd score so many like that where Henry or someone would just square it across goal and there'd be someone like Pires there to score a tap-in. And there's, you know, those goals count as much as the others.
Absolutely. How much of that do you think you give to Pep Guardiola, sort of moving him in from the wing, telling him when to arrive? Because that sort of thing, I've said it before, it's easier to... It seems easy, like you said. It seems like every player in the world should be able to do it, but it's an instinct. I'd say you can't really teach it. Players either have it and they know when they have to be there. You know, because even if you're a yard off, that ball goes past you out for a throw-in.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think Pep Guardiola has moved him in from the wing, but I think it was always there. His finishing's improved.
Yeah, though, I mean, definitely. I think what he's done is he's simplified his game. Little things like, even there used to be a thing where Raheem Sterling, when the ball came to him, he had this habit of controlling it with the outside of his boot. He couldn't really explain why he did that. It was just a thing he did. Mm. And Pep said, well, why are you doing that? If you control it with the instep, you've got it controlled quicker and you can move it on quicker.
I think there's a video of that, isn't there? Yeah. There's a video at City's training ground of Pep Guardiola. Every time the ball goes into him, Raheem's touching it with the outside and he comes over to him and he just goes, right, if you let the ball roll all the way across onto your other foot, you've opened your body up and you're away from that defender. Yeah. Whereas if you touch inside, you've cut your momentum, you're still. And it's just those little bits of management that get into.
Again, I think that's the thing of him thinking that the outside of his boot looked a bit cleverer and just trying to show his skills.
Yeah.
And he realised himself, actually, if I want to get an end product out of this, I need to move it quicker. And also, it's simplifying his game and just decision making.
Yeah.
I mean, we met him not long after the game against Kosovo where he scored, I think he set up three before half time. And you could just see from that game that every time he got the ball, he was making the right decision. He was either running with it when it was right to run, he was shooting when it was right to shoot, or he was picking out the right pass. And that wasn't probably the case always 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And
his mum's clearly got onto him about that as well.
She's just there with him every day now.
So he says in this that he thinks that he needs to win the Champions League or the European Championships or the World Cup to be in contention for a Ballon d'Or. Obviously, there's a lot of second guessing involved in this, but do you think that's probably right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at who has won the Ballon d'Or over the last few years, and admittedly that's almost always Messi and Ronaldo, they have always done something significant. I mean, even Modric won the Champions League, got to the World Cup final.
Yeah.
You've got to be the key player for a team that does, like you say, Champions League or major international tournament.
Yeah.
But you look at the 9 months ahead, Man City, I think, as far as I know, are still bookmakers' favourites for the Champions League. If they can just get over that mental hurdle that, for some reason, is stopping them. You know, it's perfectly arguable that they're the best team in Europe now. They've been the best team in Europe last season and maybe the year before that. So that's possible. He could be the star player in that. England, well, okay, we still... The defensive things against top-level teams we still need to see. But the attacking quality, if they get things together, they are capable of reaching a final, winning it. And if Raheem Sterling is in a team that wins or gets the final of the Champions League, wins or gets the final of the Euros, then he's at the very least he's in the conversation for the Ballon d'Or next year.
Final question before we move on. There was speculation that he could have been swapped for Alexis Sanchez when City were interested in him a couple of years ago. He says in this interview that, you know, City have said to him that was never really on the cards. It wasn't really a prospect, but it did get reported. Would that have been the worst swap deal of all time, given how those two players' careers have gone since?
Yes. it wouldn't look like a great idea now, let's put it that way, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's not many that would have been worse than that.
The only other one that comes to mind for me is when Blackburn swapped James Beattie for Kevin Davis in 1999.
Yeah.
But,
well, you know, Blackburn just weren't using him right. He was fine at Bolton.
Anyway, Chris, thank you. Next, we'll be chatting to Stephen McInerney about City and Raheem. You can pre-order the new issue of 442, including the Raheem Sterling interview now, and get it sent straight to your door, because you won't find it in shops yet. Just check the show notes of this episode for the details. And why not take advantage of our brilliant deal to become a subscriber to the magazine? It's £9.50 every 3 months to get in-depth interviews with the likes of Sterling, Jurgen Klopp, Diego Maradona, Virgil van Dijk, Jadon Sancho and the England Women's World Cup team, as well as interviews that take us inside Lazio's ultras, the fiery derby in the Arctic Circle, and the full story of Bury FC's sad demise. Head to myfavouritemagazines.co.uk/FFTpodcast19 to take advantage of the deal. And don't worry, that URL is also in the notes for the show. So Stephen, thanks so much for joining us today. Before we start talking about Raheem properly, I kind of want to talk a little bit about the cover. We've got him wearing the away shirt from City's 98-99 season.
Yeah.
Just to give us a bit of context about what City are like now, could you tell us a little bit about what that year was like?
Oh, that year was, I guess it was the exact opposite of everything that we are now, really. As a club, we were at our lowest ever ebb. We could have basically been stranded there. And I think it's fair to say that that season was very much, well, to many City fans, that still remains the most important. That last goal from Paul Dickov remains the most important goal in City's history. Because essentially it saved us from being stuck down in the lower tiers for a long, long time. Because we were a club in a bit of a mess. Financially, we were a club that were having to, you know, loan players from Manchester United to try and get us back up again, which is something that we never want to do as a club. But Terry Cook came in and all that kind of stuff. And basically, it was for a club like Manchester City, and God bless our fans, because we were still bringing 28,000 to 30,000 every week. But for a club of that size to be down in the third tier of English football, and we could have been stuck there forever. We had somehow failed to go up that year, and we've seen loads of clubs do a similar thing. And I think it's fair to say that if we hadn't gone up that year, then we wouldn't be seeing the Manchester City that we see today. It is, in many ways, though, it's weird looking back, and it's quite a fond memory, really, because we can safely say, and I think Manchester City's position, especially in the modern era, is totally and utterly unique to any of the big clubs around. We can safely say we've been down at the very bottom and also experienced the top and the highs, because you can't really say that for Manchester United, Liverpool, Arsenal, Chelsea fans. They can't really say they understand what it feels like, you know, to be in our shoes. So even though it was awful, and even though we were terrible, and even though we only just scraped our way back through the playoffs, that kind of defines us who we are as a club. And I think fans are quite proud of that, and rightfully so, because we've seen it from every side, and there's something quite special about that, really, to really understand and relate to other clubs. And we definitely can relate to, as fans anyway, relate to a lot of the clubs who are down there, because we've been there as well. And there's loads of great cult heroes as well from that squad, obviously Sean Gota, Paul Dickov, the likes of Ian Bishop and Andy Morrison and people like that, and Nicky Weaver. And so they're really, they're just as revered to many City fans as the likes of David Silva, and rightfully so, because they saved us, basically. And I do love that. I do love that we've seen every side of the coin. We've seen the dark days, and we've seen the really, really bright days, because not many people can say that. So, yeah, it's part of our history. I love it. I was a kid. I was only like 12, 13, or maybe, yeah, about 13, 14, something like that when it happened. And when we went down, I was devastated. And when I thought we were going to get knocked out, sorry, spent another year in the third tier, I was devastated. But you live for those moments, don't you? I never thought we'd top that moment. We did eventually, but still, I love that season. I loved it.
It's incredible to hear you say that that was probably the most important goal in City's history, because obviously most people would immediately think of that Aguero goal against QPR. But I think actually you came third that year in the third tier, and I think that was your lowest ever league finishing, which is incredible to think about what kind of team you became so quickly afterwards. In the context, obviously, it took over 10 years, but it really is such a massive change. But to move on to Sterling now, what did City fans make of him when he first signed? Because he wasn't the most popular player around when he signed for City.
Well, we were excited for him, because why wouldn't we be? Because we just signed, you know, a guy who just won the European Golden Boy Award. He was part of a really exciting attack for Liverpool. He was pace, he was dribbles, he was goals. He was an exceptionally exciting young English talent from a rival, a team that just pushed us pretty close. And obviously, there was a, I think in general, there was a little bit of skepticism because as a fan, really, and as a person, you can't really ignore a lot of the a lot of the noise that comes with anything, really. And you can't really ignore too much media stuff. And this was at a point when he was already starting to get a lot of criticism from certain quarters of the media. So there was maybe a little bit of natural and kind of unintentional skepticism from some fans. But I think largely when he signed, people were willing to support him. You know, I think a lot of City fans were excited by it because it was big money signing. He had, and thankfully he's fulfilled that, but he had exceptional potential, which we all knew. And he was already effective. It was a signing that we that even some City fans felt was maybe one for Guardiola in the future as well, because I think we all knew eventually he was going to come. And I feel like it was a good signing as well, because we took it from Liverpool, and obviously that made the world sit up and notice that, because Liverpool, you know, losing someone like Suarez to Barcelona is almost understandable, you know, because Barcelona are Barcelona. And at that time, even though Liverpool are a huge club, Barcelona were the team, you know, they had Messi, they had Iniesta, Xavi, and all that. But losing one of their most exciting players to Manchester City, this kind of, we were obviously still, we already won the league and a lot by then, but we were still very much, you know, the new kids on the block, so to speak. That did send a bit of a message. So it was an exciting signing, and one that, City fans loved it, if I'm being honest.
And what are the biggest ways in which you think his game has changed since he signed for you?
It's been interesting to watch him really grow as a person, and I presume he would have said the same thing himself. But Sterling, you could tell he came as someone who was used to being second fiddle, you know, to Lysis Suarez and so on, which is understandable. Once again, he's a world-class striker. But I think Sterling has kind of realised that his own voice is the strongest one. I really genuinely believe that. Obviously, he's a father, and he's obviously grown as an adult. He's matured, and we all know how much he changed from like 20 to 24 as an adult. You do change a lot.
Yeah.
And I think in general, he was, you say people change about every 5 years, don't they? And the personality shifts or whatever. And I do feel like Sterling as a person now, and not that he'd done anything wrong when he was younger, he was just obviously a little bit more, you know, like a rabbit caught in the headlights. And I think now, like, he is clearly much more willing to take responsibility. And to me, a big moment was actually last year in the Carabao Cup final, the last penalty, you know, with Chelsea. Mm. He stepped up to take that, like in front of thousands of people, millions of people watching worldwide. And that was the kind of moment where pretty much every City fan thought, oh no, he's going to miss this, because he wasn't good in cup, you know, in big pressure kind of cup environments. And he put it in top corner. And that like felt to me like you can draw a line in the sand. Even though he was already scoring goals at that point, but you can see he can draw a line in the sand where you feel like his conviction in his own ability. That to me was a moment where you feel like you see he'd grown and matured as a player and as a person. And I think he's realised that he can speak up, and he can be vocal, and he can be a force for good and all that kind of stuff. And he has been genuinely, and this is not exaggeration from a football fan, but he has genuinely been the victim of some incredibly unsavoury, you know, character assassinations. And it's pretty much the groundswell of support has changed, thankfully. But what he went through was genuinely insane. There was a moment in England when he went through for the second goal the other night, and when he was 1-1, and it was the quality of his finish and the composure. He kind of slightly passed the keeper. It was obviously in a horrible environment against Bulgaria. And I remember just thinking at the moment, that's the kind of goal he would not have scored a year or two ago, because he never used to have that self-belief. And more than that, I'm just happy, because obviously more than football, you're just happy that as an individual as well, that he can deal with this, because he shouldn't have to deal with it. It's nice to see that he is, you know, he's obviously grown and he's strong, and it's good to see that he's become a stronger person for it, because understandably it could crush many people, you know, what he's been through. And it's just great to see him grow, basically, as a player, but most importantly, as a human as well.
Obviously, there is Kevin De Bruyne in your squad, there's David Silva. But I think Raheem Sterling is definitely in that mix now of being possibly the best player in your team. If City were to win the Champions League over the next few years, there's obviously a very good chance that a Ballon d'Or would go to someone in your team. Who do you think would be the likeliest in the City squad at the moment to win that?
I still honestly think, it's Kevin De Bruyne. I think he's the man that makes Manchester City tick. I think Kevin De Bruyne is going to win the Ballon d'Or one day. I'm almost certain that will happen. I think he's a bit of a freak. But Ryan Sterling, you know, I think that Sterling needs to weirdly, to say he needs to score more is crazy. I think for people to take him seriously, he's going to have to sort of have some kind of like, you know, 40 goal season, I think, even now, which is mad. But he's capable of that. He's getting better in his goals, he's scoring more, and he's. I don't see any reason why he couldn't keep going. And given the fact that he's gone from a guy who used to only score a few goals a season and miss a lot of sitters, now he's, you know, getting the numbers that he's getting now, then there's absolutely no reason why he couldn't add another 5-10 goals on top of that and start getting around those numbers. So it's definitely possible. And we're going to see a bit of a vacuum left from Messi and Ronaldo leaving, you know. So when they retire and walk off into the sunset, which would be a bad day for football, but when that happens, there's going to be a bit of a free-for-all from the likes of Mbappe, you know, and then maybe João Felix will get to that level, Kevin De Bruyne, Salah will be up there, or maybe Mane will get to that level. Who knows? Well, you know. But either way, I think it's fair to say at the moment, there isn't anyone that looks to have that kind of freakish ability that those two had. So it's going to be a bit open, and there's absolutely no reason why Sterling couldn't be that. And we know, obviously, he's liked. We know he's important in football, and he's getting better. He's only young. He's got a long time left to do it. Touch wood. He's usually healthy. He plays a lot of football. He takes on what he learns, obviously, because he's improving as a player. And it's definitely possible. I think he has to be part of Manchester City team that wins the Champions League to have a chance, or maybe an England team that did something special. You know, if England did really well in the international competition, then maybe. But if Manchester City do well or England do well, Sterling's going to be a huge part of that anyway. So he's got as good a chance as anyone, really.
Is City the bookies' favourite for the Champions League this season? But it still seems that the competition isn't held in particularly high regard among fans. How come there's not more excitement around that?
It's very hard to say, and I don't want to speak for every fan, obviously, individually, because I can only give you a relatively educated kind of like guess at why, because you see it online, you see some fans who don't get it, and you see some fans who totally get it. And I think it's very much a generational thing to an extent. Like, City fans are definitely a weird mix of fans that have been around, have been watching the team when they're terrible. And obviously, we've got newer fans as well who are younger, who only knows when we were great. Then we've got ones in the middle, like myself, who you see both sides of it. But I think there's a lot of cynicism towards UEFA. And to be honest, I think that's totally fair. I think UEFA absolutely stink. And I think a lot of people don't realise how bad they can be. And we've City fans in particular, there's a lot of the old sentiment. It's not about it's not about what people think. People don't think they're like this, you know, thick straws or anything like that. It's something crazy. But it's about years ago when we had a stadium ban for racism from, you know, another team, and City fans were banned from it and all that kind of stuff. And they couldn't go despite paying for the tickets. And it all stems from that. And it stems from loads of silly little things. And in general, I think there's also just a lot of cynicism, I guess, towards a tournament that we've never really felt kind of part of. I want Manchester City to win it, of course. And I'm personally in the group that I always want to be champions of your country first. I just believe that, like, it's more important. I don't think you're the best in the world if you win the Champions League, like, by default. I think you also have to be the best in your country for it to. You don't have to be, of course, but I think it definitely eliminates any doubt. Like, no one would say, for example, when Roberto Di Matteo got in Chelsea to Champions League, that they were the best team in Europe. You know, they were terrible, like, mainly terrible, like, in the league and all that kind of stuff. So competitions are a little bit random. So I always prefer the Premier League. But now I feel like, given City have won so dramatically and so impressively, won a couple of leagues, I do feel like I would, for the first time first time ever, really, I would definitely take the Champions League over the Premier League, because there's no doubt for many people that Manchester City are the best team in England over the past 2 or 3 years. You know, no one can really question that. So I feel like we are ready for that moment. Maybe we just need a moment. You know, maybe we need something to connect with it. And Guardiola said as well, like, Barcelona didn't win the Champions League for like 100 years of their existence or something like that, you know, the European Cup. So sometimes you need that history with a competition to feel part of it. And I guess with all the stuff from UEFA and about when you see, it's tenuous, but you see, obviously, the comments about Manchester City ruining football, and you get it from, like, you know, high up officials and all that kind of stuff. And there's a lot of cynicism towards competition. Personally, I don't agree with all of it. I agree with some of it. But I feel like we maybe lack a moment to maybe feel like that we belong, you know, as a club. And I think if we had a big night, and say we, I think what we've never had really is a night where we've done something special in that competition. I know we beat Barcelona 3-1 at one point, but it was a group stage game, you know, and it doesn't feel something. I feel like if we had a big, I know we nearly got there, but I think as well, when we got to semi-finals and with Pellegrini, and we were shambolic, you know, in the case of Real Madrid, and we didn't get a single shot on target in 180 minutes. I feel like if we had a moment where we had a big club like that, and we took the game to them, we showed how good we could be, and the fans got behind it on a night, and we had our own famous European night, maybe the emotion could change. But until then, I'm expecting a bit of cynicism. I know one day it'll change. You just we'll get used to it, and it'll become part of the scenery. So.
So City have already had a couple of shaky results in the league this season. What are your weaknesses this year?
Familiarity, I guess. It's people get used to us. It's also a little bit of bad luck is involved in anything, really. The amount of injuries you get all of a sudden, there's not much you can do about that. You know, when you have several key players out. A little bit of bad management, but maybe not being as accurate as you wanted to be in the transfer market. Having Vincent Kompany leave, then also losing Laporte is just like, it's the worst case scenario, basically. We've gone from having experienced top-class defenders to two less, and then Stones going out, and then we've left with one defender, and that stuff does affect you, and you suddenly... and this wasn't meant to happen, because we were meant to have, you know, Rodri's come in, he looks fantastic, to be fair to him, but he could have done with a stable team around him, you know, not changes constantly. And it's also football, you know, football happens, and sometimes a perfect storm can happen. And for example, Norwich, we were a mess with injuries and timing, and Norwich were excited. You know, they were new to the league. They had nothing to lose, and not new to the league, you know, recently, obviously been there before, but it just happened. And we'll get back on track. We will do. We'll start winning games again. It's just we need to get our defenders back. Stones being back, hopefully, will be huge. I don't think we've worked out how to play without Laporte yet. And I just think maybe as well we're probably missing Vincent Kompany's influence, because he's a one-of-a-kind. Even if he's not playing, having him around the squad, he focuses it. I'm sure we'll replace it. I'm sure we'll get on. But he's always going to be in a spell of under any manager, a moment where your excellent standards drop a little bit. It just obviously depends how you react to it. We can't expect 3 years of perfection, you know, in the league. So fingers crossed we get back on track. But I reckon we'll probably run Liverpool very close, and who knows how it'll end the season. Just fingers crossed the defenders are back soon, because that'd be really nice.
Do you think that you might have to enter the transfer market for defenders in January?
I'm sure, despite what they say, they're probably looking at it. I think the only chance we've got is maybe someone who's got a release fee clause, something like that, because the January tax is ridiculous, right, as is the Manchester City tax. And as much as we spend a lot of money, they usually do try and stick to what they think they can afford.
Yeah.
Hence why we did pull out for, like, ridiculously, for over, you know, not ridiculously, but like it was crazy how last minute it was with the Jorginho stuff. And then Harry Maguire, City were obviously in for him in the summer, but didn't work out to much as 80 million, whether that's right or not. That's none of my business, you know. I don't tend to care too much about the finance side, because I just like watching football. But the club obviously will stick to it. I don't think we'll end up signing anyone. There's rumours that someone like Ruben Dias could have a release fee clause, which is makes it easier, obviously, because there's less haggling and stuff like that. Well, there's none at all, really. You just get it on with. But I think we'll say we're not going to be in for one, but I reckon we will look at it. Whether I think it'll happen or not, I don't think it will do. I think we'll just kind of make do and get to the summer.
So finally, obviously, we've got to talk about Pep Guardiola a little bit. He's been at City now longer than he was at Bayern Munich. By the end of this season, he'll have matched his time in charge of Barcelona.
Yeah.
Is there an expectation that he might leave soon?
I think he'll definitely fulfil his contract. His circumstances are quite unique compared to what he had at Barcelona and Bayern. And at Barcelona, he obviously, he's quite famous for the year of football because of burnout and stress. And that wasn't really to do with the football. It was obviously to do, it was because he was basically, and he's a lot of people close to him, you know, people write, you know, the books about him and all that kind of stuff, is he was basically used as the pawn in, you know, a presidential battle. Mm. And he hated all the politics side of it. And Bayern, you've got like so many ex-players, you know, in the media telling him how to manage. And he never really warmed to it. I don't think he ever warmed to the crowd over there and warmed to life at Bayern, even though he did well. But I think at City, the club's been built for him. You know, the modern version of Manchester City has been built for Guardiola, and he's even said in quotes where he's never been as content in a situation that but he's even friends now with City's owner. And obviously he's got Cheeky Bregenstein of Ferran Soriano, who's known from his time at Barcelona, who are basically his closest friends in football. And he is the boss there. He's the man. And like, City do everything they can to keep him happy. There's no internal politics. There's no shareholders arguing with him about things or anything like that. He doesn't have to be the man who deals with stuff that isn't football in the press conferences. I think he's happy here, and I think he'll stick to his contract just because he has another year left after this. Just out of respect, really, to his friends, the director of football, all that kind of stuff, and for the chairman, because like, he's obviously paid very well and they put a perfect scenario in for him. And I think he'll want one more year just to slightly, obviously, the transition of, you know, the likes of David Silva and obviously company's gone and all the old guard are moving on. I think he could go at the end of his 5 years. Might be wrong, he might go after 4 years, but I can't see it. I think we'd probably know by now a little bit stronger, you know, if he was going to do that. I think there'd be leaks and stuff like that. Could be wrong, hopefully I'm not, but I think 5 years you'll see that out and then probably take a year out and go off to Italy or something like that. Or maybe, well, he's definitely not going to manage Spain, put it that way, given everything that's going there at the moment. He'll manage someone internationally one day, but he definitely won't be Spain.
It's interesting that you say the club was built for him. Obviously, the project to get Pep to Man City started well before he joined. But do you think that the club has been built to outlast him? Can the kind of project that he has put in place since arriving could carry on once he's gone?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I think the difference with Barcelona is obviously they lost the people who helped build that, you know, Barcelona. And I do believe, I don't think he'll be as good, because I do believe Pep is, he's the best at managing a really expensive, highly oiled machine. I think he is that. Obviously, money's a big part of it, but, you know, you don't give Lewis Hamilton the keys to, you know, a Skoda. You give him, you know, one of the best Formula cars in the world, and people say, could he do it at Doncaster? Like, well, why would he want to do it at Doncaster? You know, like, well, for what it's worth, I think he could make anyone a better footballer. I think he could make me and you a better footballer, you know, because I think he obviously understands football that much. But I think City have a procession planning. I think City, like, it's like, as much as it is all about money, of course it's about money, I'm not stupid, but you've only got to look at what City are doing, you know, with the City Football Group and stuff like that, where they're expanding their portfolio of clubs around the world. They're doing something genuinely that's never been done before. And I think City's designs, people don't quite realise how extensive they are and how much they're really, like, trying to commodify the sport and, like, kind of do things that haven't been done before. Whether you agree with it or not is a different question entirely, but They know, I believe they know who's going to be the manager after the manager of Guardiola. I really believe that far in advance. And then we're seeing things now where we've almost got, like, I was chatting to someone the other day, and like, most clubs have, you know, young players out on loan and stuff like that. It feels like City have got young managers out on loan as well. Like, it feels that way. Like, we've got Dominic Torrent, like, obviously he's Pep's right-hand man. He's gone for a stint at New York City and he's won the league over there. And then we've got, obviously, Patrick Vieira was there for a little bit, and I feel like we're seeing, like, coaches now, like, being groomed to be the next manager as well. So we've got a bunch of clubs where we can plant a manager to see how they get on. It's weird. I don't think we've ever seen that before by clubs. And yeah, I think I've not really thought about it that way until recently. But there actually are. They are grooming the next manager on loan somewhere else, keeping them within the City Football Group. And I think that's the way they'll do it. I wouldn't be surprised if we see, like, someone like Arteta be lined up next. Or we've even seen recently, I'm not sure you've noticed, Giovanni van Bronckhorst has come into Manchester City to do almost like as he called it, an internship, which is crazy. Like, what does that even mean? He's been managing a top European club and done pretty well, you know. And now he's learning at Manchester City. So I think what City are doing is, like, people, I think they're so far ahead of how other clubs think sometimes. And when you go through City's transfers, there's a lot of money, but they work, you know. they were not, people assume City have bought, you know, a bunch of Galacticos. They don't really do that. They spend a lot of money, yes, but, like, Leroy Sane wasn't a big star beforehand. Gabriel Jesus wasn't a big star beforehand. They were very good young players, definitely. But they weren't, like, you know, they weren't Kylian Mbappe wonder kids from, you know, from PSG or something like that. They were the next generation. And I think City's hit rate for transfers is good because they're so well planned, and we've got the money and we know how to spend it, basically. So I think, like, there is a plan for after Guardiola. And I think there's plans for after Guardiola, after Guardiola. And I'm not looking forward to that day because I still think he's the best in the world. I think, like, the way you look at what happened to Barca in a post-Guardiola world, I think they've dropped and lost their identity. And I think the challenge is to try and replicate that, and I think they want to. But I think we know what we're going to do. Whether it'll be successful, I don't know. But yeah, I think we've got a plan for it.
Steve, thank you very much.
My pleasure, mate.
Thanks to Chris, Hunter and Stephen for joining me on the podcast today. If you've enjoyed the show, please leave a 5-star rating and a kind review on iTunes. It really does help. The new issue of 442 with the in-depth interview with Raheem Sterling is available to order now. And while you're doing it, why not consider getting someone a subscription to the magazine for Christmas too? It's not too early. Next week, we'll be back covering El Clásico and how Barcelona and Real Madrid can get back to the top of Europe. The music you've heard is from Howell Griff, also available on iTunes and Spotify. Thanks for listening.
Stay warm for a while, 18 degrees on Saturday. Cooler though as we head through the week across all areas. Have a good afternoon.
What's this? It's all right, Daddy's here. Come on. What's this?
You might be surprised to know that you can get de facto 5-star life insurance from Aviva from just £5 a month. Yep, thought so.
Don't put it off. Get a life insurance quote today. Direct at aviva.co.uk.